Welcome to the Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast, conversations with leaders who made difficult decisions and built lasting legacies. I am Rick Williams. I speak and write about how leaders can be more successful. My best-selling book, Create the Future, is your essential guidebook for making difficult decisions. This podcast is an opportunity for me and for you to hear how leaders with a wide variety of backgrounds have managed the challenges they faced, made difficult decisions, and had courage when going forward is tough. You will learn important lessons from other leaders. You will find that engaging with our 30-minute conversation will be a great investment of your valuable time. So let's get started. Welcome to the Create the Future podcast. I'm Rick Williams. The Create the Future podcast is a forum for leaders to share their stories about making difficult decisions for their company or for any organization, and in some cases for themselves. My goal is to share these stories of leadership and making tough calls with a broader leadership community so you will be a more successful leader of your organization. We have a great guest today with a compelling story to tell. You will hear about lessons learned, what worked, what didn't work in some cases, and perhaps what he felt he should do a little bit differently in the future. I'm excited to introduce you to Eugene Manley. Eugene is the founder and CEO of STEM and the Cancer Health Equity. Eugene helps organizations translate scientific progress into measurable, trusted, and equitable patient outcomes. Eugene, welcome to the Create the Future podcast. Take a moment and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your path up to this point.
Thank you so much for having me on, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here, and you're doing such great work at bringing leadership and leadership decisions to the masses. I am, as you stated, Dr. Eugene Manley Jr., and I have a long path to get me to where I am today. By training, I'm a mechanical engineer.
Part of what we're going to hear today is this path that you personally have gone through, which is so wonderful and compelling. I definitely want to hear more about it. So that's why I'm so excited to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. So I started as a mechanical engineer, a biomedical engineer.
Now, wait a second. Where did you grow up? I want to start
Detroit.
Start with the basics.
I grew up in Detroit.
It is really important to hear who the heck this guy really is. So let's start with the basics. Where were you born and grown up?
I grew up inner city Detroit, basically my whole life, but I spent my summers as a kid until I was 10 in southern West Virginia. So that is the foundation of where I grew up and saw the world and saw what worked well and what didn't. And I grew up with allergies and asthma, spent a lot of time in the hospital. So it sort of laid a foundation for me to become a scientist indirectly.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's keep going. I don't want to leave out the important part of this. So of that is crucial to understanding who you are and your mission today.
Yep. And if we keep going in that track, my father was a chronic smoker. And I had really, really bad asthma. I was in the hospital 20 to 30 times a year just for my asthma until I was 10. And that sort of made me have an appreciation for medicine and treating people. And also as a kid, I grew up in the 80s. So Transformers came out. So I played a lot with GoBots, Transformers, made model cars, and read a lot of books. So my brain was always going back and forth between engineering and biology. And my science department head said, you should probably think about biomedical engineering as a career. And she was the very first person that helped me get a biomedical research job. In 11th grade, there's a apprenticeship program at the Michigan Cancer Foundation. Mm. And she told me about it, told me to apply. And then once I learned there were these research programs you could do, from that point on, after high school and every summer in college, I applied for research programs just to get that experience. And I did the undergrad in engineering and went up to Michigan Tech, which is a really, really rigorous engineering school. And I took my fourth year and went to England on an exchange program, which you think, Why would you go abroad? It was one of the best things that I did, minus the weather, because the wet wind and damp. But you travel, and when you get us out of your comfort zone, you learn that people all have similar goals. They want to do something, they want to be successful, they want to be happy. And so I think a lot of the issues we broadly face, just let people be happy. It will be much easier that way. But I learned, just, living in a northern part of England, what that was like. And then when I came back, I went to Florida, to National, to Florida International University, because I was not ready to go back to the Upper Peninsula. So I did another year in another exchange program. And then I said, oh, I guess I have to go back and graduate now. So and then I went back up there. But what I did is the undergrad was mechanical engineering, and I spent all my summer doing biomedical research. So that meant I never really meshed my degree. So I was an engineer on paper, but a biologist by work. And so I couldn't get an engineering job because of that. And I couldn't get a biology job because I didn't have a biology degree. So I ended up finally doing the master's in biomedical engineering at Wisconsin and worked in knee ligament mechanics and really got good at dissecting bones and testing them. And I said, okay, we should do the molecular stuff so I can make some kind of impact. And so I ended up in Boston University in molecular and cell biology and biochemistry. And I worked in a lab. I mean, I was there 9 years, but it was a lot of work. But I learned so much about drug metabolism, the differences in drug metabolism between sexes. But the bulk of my work was in lung cancer, and by lung cancer biology, combination drug therapies. And then when I finished, I was torn between going into the postdoc or getting a faculty job or getting an industry. And then I ended up doing postdocs because I thought I wanted to study cancers that metastasize the bone. So I did some postdocs in more bone biomechanics, breast cancer, multiplex imaging, which is just a the simple way of saying you can stain tissues with multiple antibodies. But then as I got near the end, I was just getting frustrated with not getting grants written, not getting help getting grants, and sometimes being in labs that look great on paper, but then you get there and then you have to, someone that has a massive ego, or you can't ask for letters of recommendation, or you can't ask for time off. So you have to figure out how you're going to do your own professional development and how are you going to advance. And so you a lot of my leadership, besides me wanting to help people, is sort of learning how not to treat people and how not to hinder them. And then that led me to the nonprofit space, where I've worked at the AACR, Lung Cancer Research Foundation, and Longevity. And to try to keep it simple, the work sort of first started in, fundraising and development, really using all my biology and engineering skills to, reach out to companies and get AACR programs funded. And then I went to Lung Cancer Research Foundation and oversaw the grant administration system. And that meant I had to do a lot of outreach to reviewers to get grants scored and assessed. And then that's when patients started reaching out to me to ask me to develop content around lung cancer disparities. And that was very interesting because when I did my PhD in lung cancer, we were not thinking about disparities in the early 2000s. It just wasn't even on the radar. And then I said, I guess I could talk about this. So I started talking more about lung cancer disparities and then the position at
And
Longevity.
disparity meaning what does disparity mean? Just so
So a
we're tracking with what's
disparity
in your head.
is basically a difference in an outcome. Could be for a disease or a condition, and this disparity could be just, unequal outcomes. It could be based on race, income, education, lifestyle, rural, urban. I mean, most people think of just disparities in race, and that's generally what we talk about, but it could be any under that umbrella. And so I did a lot of work with, talking about Black and Hispanic communities navigating lung cancer. And the lack of diversity in trials, the lack of diversity in patient samples, and how this impacts then who gets treatments and who benefits from it. And so then that led me to lung cancer, to Longevity, where I was the director of STEM Workforce Initiatives, and I had created their minority mentorship and training program for the health equity grant awardees. to combine grant writing with outreach and advocacy in underserved communities. I ran three virtual health equity series around lung cancer, asking questions about clinical trials, community engagement, outreach, and I oversaw a couple programs to give public health students training in asking population data or leadership questions around lung cancer. And then I launched my new org in August of 2023, the STEM and Cancer Health Equity Foundation.
I'm going to ask a completely ignorant question here. STEM, are you just referring to STEM as the way we use that term in the technical literature? Is it, or does STEM stand for something? I'm not tracking on
This
what it
STEM,
stands.
I use two M's. So when we talk, typically when we talk about STEM or STEM careers, some people just use STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. I use a second M at the end, which is medicine. You don't have to use it.
Okay, got
And
it.
some people say STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. So they're general variations of the same term, but it's really trying to increase capacity of people to enter STEM careers and hopefully get them to propel and stay in those careers.
Sure. Okay. All right. No, just so we're all clear what we're talking about here. So your basic education, well, first of all, you started life as a kid who experienced, life as somebody who's not living well off on Upper East Side Manhattan or the wealthy suburbs of Boston. You were living where the real people live and experienced life personally for yourself like that, and then went into science and engineering, which is wonderful, and then you transitioned to helping understand how science and medicine, particularly, is being delivered to across populations to say, gee, are there gaps here for delivery that we're not even necessarily aware of? And sort of that's been the evolution of your career up to this point. Is that right?
Yes, and it's always been from a lens of who's included, who's excluded, who's
Yeah.
benefiting, who is not, and how do we bring voice so that those that aren't there either have someone fighting on their behalf or we can educate people on what to ask for.
Okay. All right. Well, so this is a great background. So now I know you wanted to come on to the podcast and talk about making a difficult decision that you had to make, and that we could learn from it, learn from your experience of having to go through all of this. So share us the dilemma that you faced and what happened.
So we run an annual lung cancer health equity or lung cancer intervention summit, and its goal is to bring together patients, caregivers, survivors, researchers, clinicians, payers, hospital systems to not just talk about the problems underserved communities face, but what solutions different stakeholders are creating at all levels that are actually reducing disparities and improving outcomes. And so it's a lot of work to find speakers that understand the issues these communities face, that have cultural awareness if they're not from that community to understand how to speak and present. And we want people that are dedicated to bringing these issues to light because often these communities are ignored. And basically, I already had most of the program done at this point, and I was talking to a company founder who has a product, I guess, for screening tissues, or I think screening tissues or cells for biochemical markers. And I already had the program designed, and we were on a call, and it just went off the rails from the beginning. And they're just coming firing at me. Well, you need to do this, and you have to do this, and what about this? And, why aren't we getting a speaking spot? And we should be giving a primary spot, and we should give more, be given more time to speak than what you're giving your keynote. And he just kept going the whole call. And my brain is like, am I hearing this correctly? Like, are you telling me what I have to do for my meeting that you've never been to? You aren't in the space. You don't have a diverse population that you routinely deal with, but you want me to put you up there to say your product is great. And they've never seen it. And I was just so taken aback at the call, I almost just disconnected the call. I said, I have better things to do, but I let him get through his car. And then I had to go to physical therapy that day because I was recovering from my foot surgery. And then I won't say I was stewing. I was just pondering, okay, what will I say in response? And then I did my physical therapy. And then, the brain started, okay, what can I say? And like, and then I got home and I wrote an email. I said, I will make this abundantly clear to you. Never in your life will you order or dictate or tell me anything I have to do for you. Like, it does not work this way. I know the community I work with is diverse and underserved. They never see people like them in spaces. They never see people like them speaking. So you want me to have a white person come and dictate and push people out that already have scheduled to give you a primary slot. And you didn't want to pay to be a premier sponsor and you've not attended before. So where do you think you're going to get in this space? And I said, with the underlay of how race and ethnicity intersect in this country, I also said, do you use this attitude when you're on a call with other white orgs that you thought you just you did it with black ones or just mine? I
Now
said,
you're
because
talking to this person on the phone.
I wrote that in the email because I said, does
You
this
wrote in
how
the
you
video. Got it. Got it.
because
Got
I
it. Okay.
emailed him back because I was just like, what? And I said, is this how you routinely communicate? Like, why would you think anyone would want you to be at this event or show up if this is your attitude? Like, I would. And so that was, and it wasn't hard. It took me some time to say, what do I want to say? And say calm and not really say what I was thinking. But I was just, the hubris was just, I was like, that's not gonna fly. And that was, I was pretty stern with my message. I said,
Now,
never
wait a
again. I
second.
said,
I want to say, is your finger up saying, do I press the send button or not? Where are you in this process?
I wrote it, I stepped away from the computer, came back 20 minutes later, stepped away again, and then after about an hour, I said, nope, send. I said, at the end of the day, I am the face of this org. I'm representing the people that don't have a voice at the table. I cannot let someone who's not even from this community try to bulldoze their way in. I said, nope, not acceptable. And I said, it is my org and my event. Like, who do you think you are to try to dictate? I said, we don't play that. That's probably the least professional thing I've just said.
Okay, so I take it your computer didn't blow up after you press send, is that
No, but
right?
sometimes you don't normally use strong language, but if someone comes at you like that, you either absorb it, which a lot of us have to do. But I said, no, I run my own work. I can say whatever I want. And if it causes me to lose a relationship, that is fine. But you have to understand what your core principles are, how you want to be communicated with, and what you will and will not tolerate. You have to have your core principles. And if
Yeah.
someone railroad, you cannot let anyone railroad you. That is just rule one. That's and respect and decency. That's just you can't give that up.
Okay. I got to tell you, this is a very important conversation to have because I know this is a very personal experience for you, but I mean what you went through is what a lot of people have to face, and hearing your story and learning how you experience this is valuable to a lot of people. So I'm going to ask you later whether what response you got, but let's focus on you and your doing this. So you said you walked away from the computer. Did you, I don't know, send copies to other people, or was it just you sending this to him? And presumably it's a him, you sending this to him, and you didn't involve other people, or you involving other people? What were you, did you, so did you involve other people in terms of sending this to people?
I did not, except one
Okay.
person sort of knows the org, and I ran it by them, and they said, I would understand why you would be upset, and I would have probably done the same thing. The only difference is it's easier to write that kind of email when you're the CEO than if you're like a manager or a director, because at the end of the day, the buck stops with me. So I have from my position, I could do that. Now, if I wasn't the founder, I probably would have to do something more measured. But you sometimes have to be willing to walk away from business to stand on principles.
Right. Okay, I'm going to take a little line of a line of conversation here, which I hope you're okay with. So, you're black, I'm white. So let's just acknowledge that as we're having this conversation. I know that you were in Dublin, you were in Northern England in school. You were one of the few blacks who were there. I don't know what it was like when you're undergraduate. But you're the black in a predominantly white culture in a lot of situations. My guess is that you are particularly sensitive to, okay, I as an individual want to be accepted, and I don't want to just act like a jerk and have people think of me as sort of the outsider who's a jerk. And I say that in the context of doing something like this, where you are, I think, absolutely on target. Who are you as an individual? And how do you want to be acting in a situation like this, given who you are as an individual? So I think it's great. I'm wondering whether you thought about, gee, I really want to be accepted by this white CEO. And maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Talk to us a little bit about how you think about doing stuff like this as a minority who is not part of the sort of white majority. And I say this with great fondness and friendship for you, and trying to understand how you thought about it, because I think it'd be valuable for everybody to hear how you think about this.
So I'll say this, and this might be a generalization, but often when you are a black professional, you always still have to deal with the hierarchical system and what they're comfortable with you saying or doing or behaving. So you always have to comport yourself in what we've termed professionalism, which I find issue with because usually professionalism is used to tone behavior, attitude, and not impact. And also, I navigate life with, for the longest, undiagnosed ADHD, which also created a lot of friction in systems because they want you to either be a yes person or jump when they say jump. And I'm just like, no. But as far as the in navigating white spaces, I grew up in Detroit, but my undergrad prepared me more for the world than anything else because I went to Michigan Tech on Lake Superior. I think when I was there, at no point did we have more than 1% black students. So I think the school was roughly 6,000. We never had more than maybe 100 students that were black, maybe 1.150, but it's always been a small number. But it was also a very strong engineering school. So you didn't go up there if you were trying to party. You were going because you were trying to do work. So, and we faced the whole perspective. You only got in because of affirmative action. I said, no black person in their right mind is going to come up this far because of affirmative action. We got in because we could do the work, but it prepared us for what the world sometimes sees of us. So when we would be in group projects, we would have to jump to say we'd be in a group project because otherwise you get left behind. And what you learn is the further up you go in your degree, like, the sophomore, junior, senior, your classes become less and less diverse because either people are at internships or have graduated. And so that also prepares you for the real corporate world. And so I honestly say I found England a break and refreshing because I know this is going to sound counterintuitive, but when you grow up in the US where everything is sort of has an underlay of race, ethnicity to it, and you're always under a microscope, it was actually fun to be in a spot where I didn't necessarily have to, like, oh my God, they are looking at me, or they're going to profile, or am I worried? Am I going to get arrested by a cop for just asking a question? And so it, I know this sounds so crazy, but it is like it was such a relief to not have the whole societal pressures that are placed on you in the US on me. It was, minus the weather, it was a great year.
Well, okay. So I first of all, thank you. So let's go back to this. You're writing this email saying, "Hey, you're not going to treat me like this." Were you afraid when you thought about sending that? I know you walked away from the computer. Talk about your experience as an individual, getting yourself to the courage to say this. I mean, in my mind, there are two elements here: courage And also your clarity about who you are as an individual. I think those are both so important when you're faced with having to make a tough decision.
And yes, you're absolutely correct. So was the courage to send it was never the issue. It was the conviction to make sure when I sent it, I was okay with any repercussions. And but when you are irresolute in your guiding principle, your North Star, and you know I didn't work all this time to get to a leadership position to let someone outside just try to ramrod me. I said, no, you cannot ever accept that. That is that you because if you accept that, then everyone will still keep running over you, which is what you probably already dealt with your whole career. So then at what point are you going to be willing to stand on the ground that you are comfortable in? And so I was comfortable with that, and I said, I'm accepting the consequences. But that's also leadership. You know, leadership isn't always I'm the leader, everything is great. It's you have to make tough decisions, you have to be able to stand in the decisions you make, and you also generally should be helping bring people up so that they can be great leaders, which a lot of people don't do. But that is sort of, but leadership is multiple facets. It's not just I'm the big person at the top. I have to help people, I have to bring them on, but I also have to make sure convictions and decor. I mean, you know, you have to figure out what you're willing to stand for, and whatever those are, never compromise whatever your core being is. And so because I'm so used to being the only person in a space, I can't ever give anyone my space and let them take it from me. I just can't.
Well, that's great. I'm wondering now, we have to hear the rest of the story. What happened after you sent this email?
And so then eventually they did email me back and said, you know, I apologize. I didn't mean it to come off that way. I respect what you do. But you know, and I was like, okay, that's fine. But and that was it. But I said, I don't really have much more to say. But you know, the attitude should have never happened. So I didn't feel I needed to re-bring it up and rehash it. It wouldn't change what was done. But you know, that brought up a lot of, let's just say I was pretty steaming internally, and I said, let me calm down. And you know, and because I have the ADHD, you know, and I had to not say the first thing that came to my mind because we're very reactive. So sometimes this ADHD and leadership, you have to really learn that emotional intelligence. Like, let me walk and think and make sure I'm saying what I want to say. And so I usually will do this when I have to write important things. I take time just to make sure it's the right tone, the right style, the right context. But that one, I just want to make sure I said my point. I wasn't so worried about how he perceived it, because the insult was already thrown, and like, my work is not important. You think you're some superior? No, that's absolutely not acceptable. Not when I've worked all this time to get to this space.
Well, I think this is great. I also one of the things I talk about in making difficult decisions like this is to, when you can, engage with your, if you have a leadership team around you, to say, hey, let's get together and talk about this for a minute. I've got to make this decision. Give me your feedback. And the way I talk about it is that I say that successful leaders have to be both decisive, meaning they're willing to make decisions. And that's a thing that a lot of leaders are not willing to do. They say, gee, let's put this off. Anyway, be decisive, being willing to make decisions, but also be vulnerable, be open to learning and hearing from other people. And having that as part of the process that I, as an individual, go through when I'm making important decisions. Because, if I'm not willing to say, hey, can I learn from someone else that they might have a more nuanced understanding of the problem or a better way of approaching it, then over time, I will not make as good decisions, as successful decisions, as I will if I'm open to learning and hearing from other people, being both decisive and vulnerable. That is the way that I talk about this process. And I even though you're not verbally saying that, I'm sensing that that's probably what you do as well.
Yes, and I do have a board, and I did talk to them about it, and they were fine with it because they kind of understood it, like, yeah, that's not acceptable. So I did tell them later, but they would have said, okay. That's something they would not have stopped me on, because there's so few black people to get in these positions, and we always are getting policed in tone and like, no, this is one time. I'm like, no, I will not accept that. And because I have CEO, I could do that strong pushback and be comfortable with it. And like I said, if I was a director or a middle manager, then you have to run it up the chain. And then that's where you're waiting to see, what should I say? How is this going to affect your reputation? And I was like, I will stand in the ground that I'm on for this particular principle.
No, what you're saying about affecting your reputation is very important because that is what's in our minds often. Are people going to like me? Will I be losing friends? Will I be, not part of the in crowd if I'm doing this or saying this? And if you're going to grow to maturity and grow to be successful as a leader, and what I'm talking about here, then you have to get really clear about who you are as an individual and in your role as a leader, and then make your decisions and do your things, which you want to be a reflection of who you are as a leader, and not just whether everybody's going to like you or not.
Yep,
And
that
that is an extremely important transition that you have to go through in order to become a successful leader.
and you bros bro you put up a very good point. Leadership is not necessarily about likability. Doesn't mean you have to be hated, but you are always going to find people that will not like you, and that is okay. That is life, but you cannot let that be the whole barometer for how you measure your success or productivity. You just can't let that be the factor.
Well, Eugene, before we wrap this up, are there any follow-ups to this that how you modified a little bit how you did things or whatever that you want to share with our audience? I want to give you an opportunity to have the last word here if you want to do
Well,
that.
the biggest thing is, you have to, like I said, I'll just reiterate, you have to understand, one, who you are fundamentally, who you advocate for, and how you want to be treated or acknowledged. And you have to, whatever your lines you don't cross, then do not let anyone cross them. Everything else you can deal with. So be, know who you are, know your purpose, know what you're trying to do, and be comfortable with those making decisions based on that.
Well, Eugene, this has been great. I am so thankful that you have come on and shared this experience. It's very valuable to me, and I know to other listeners. So, A, thank you for sharing your experiences. I know you've made a valuable contribution to our understanding of the challenges leaders face every single day. If people in the audience want to get in touch with you or learn more about what you're doing, how can they do that? How can they find you and get in touch with you?
The easiest ways are find me on LinkedIn. It's Eugene Manley Jr., PhD. Instagram, Manley Eugene. And you can find Shek, SCHEQ.org. And I do have a new LLC that I launched a month ago, Innovation for Impact Consulting. And that's where I focus more on my speaking and leadership stuff. So I'm starting to literally set that up literally as of about a month ago. So it's slowly ramping up. And if you want to email me, just info@shech.org, SCHEU.org is sufficient to get to me.
Well, that's great. And again, thank you so much. I also want to thank our audience for tuning in and learning from our guests. I hope you found this valuable. If you have a compelling story to tell about difficult decisions you've made, consider coming on the Create the Future podcast yourself. I think I'd welcome guests who raise their hand and say, I really want to be part of this conversation. So if you want to do that, go to Rick WilliamsLeadership.com and then go to the Create the Future podcast page on the website. Again, that's RickWilliamsLeadership.com. So remember that you create the future by the decisions you make today. And when you're facing a really important challenge or have to make a very important decision, slow down and take the time to get it right. Until next time, be well. What an interesting and inspiring conversation. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. Thank you for listening. Let me know if you have a compelling story to tell about making tough choices for your organization or for yourself. Coming on my podcast is a way to share what you have learned with a wider audience. If someone you know would be a great guest, please make an introduction. I welcome leaders with a story to tell and important learning to share. You can contact me about the podcast at podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. That's podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. Please share the link to my podcast with your colleagues. They will thank you for getting them access to these valuable conversations. And finally, please give us a great rating on and subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Just search for Create the Future with Rick Williams. Thank you for listening to Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast. Conversation with leaders who make difficult decisions and build lasting legacies.